Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome you to the House Committee on Revenue. Today is the 28th of April, Thursday, 2005. Scheduled to commence at 1:15. We're just a couple minutes late. We appreciate your indulgence while we have been getting started late. Folks, let me just, by way of announcement, let you know that we've got double postings. We've got three bills for public hearing this afternoon that I've also got posted over to, I think Friday, is that right, Paul? Monday, that we've got posted over to Monday. So we've got some other health bills that we're going to hear that day. But I understand that there's some folks that are here today that may not be able to make it another time that need to testify on either House Bills 2514, House Bill 2787, or House Bill 3348. If you're here and need to testify on those, or if you've got a broken leg, you might be able to testify one of those. I see Damiana back there squirming. So with that, we'll go ahead this morning, or this afternoon, and we do need to go ahead and open and close the public hearings, but I'm going to ask the clerk to go ahead and bring forward those sign-ups for those three public hearings, please. With that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2514. Lizbeth?
Excuse me for just a moment, Lizbeth.
Go ahead. Let me make this announcement. Colleagues, it's very rare that I get one or two of my constituents, but I have two of my constituents here today in Salem. One is back at the hotel, and the other is my brother Bob. Bob, I've got a vice chair here that says that she thinks polo shirts, red polo shirts with ties or with suspenders are really sexy. So.
I didn't use the word sexy, but I found it very
alluring. The word is alluring.
Is that the word you use?
Mr. Chair, did this constituent actually vote for you?
We'll leave politics. That's an interesting story, and we'll get into that another time. So, Elizabeth, the public hearing on House Bill 2514.
Chairman Butler, with House Bill 2514, this is dealing with the rural medical providers tax credit, and that's what all three of these public hearing bills are dealing with this morning or this afternoon. And it's adding licensed psychologists to the list of rural medical providers who can qualify for the rural medical providers tax. It allows the Office of Rural Health to identify the rural areas for which psychologists can provide psychological services, which qualifies then the provider for the tax credit. It provides the Office of Rural Health the authority to establish criteria for certifying individuals as eligible for this tax credit. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2009. And just as brief background on this rural medical provider tax credit, it was enacted in 1989, and it really is designed to attract new medical practitioners and to continue medical practices in these underserved rural areas. And under current law, the rural medical practice tax credit has an annual cap of $5,000. The tax credit can be claimed by the following providers. You can be a physician, a surgeon, physician assistant, nurse practitioner, registered nurse anesthesiologist, a dentist, optometrist, and at least 60% of the provider's practice must be spent in a qualifying rural area to receive the tax credit. And basically, the Office of Rural Health then has established, the criteria for rural. And I have given you in one of the other bills some data from the Department of Revenue where they have merged the Office of Rural Health's listing of those who have applied and been certified to receive the tax credit with the tax return data. And we can discuss that more when we begin one of the other bills. But basically, this is just allowing psychologists into being eligible for the rural medical provider tax.
Colleagues, Representative Barnhart and I have worked on issues relative to the psychology profession over a couple or three sessions now, and I want you to know that there are a couple of bills floating around, one of which also is probably being examined relative to psychologists who finished 3 years of pharmacology capable of and take the examinations necessary to do so, being able to prescribe psychotropic medicines to their to their patients. So, again, there's Oregon would, if that were to pass, Oregon would be one of the few states and the nation that has that provision. I think since Representative Barnard came up with that program a few years ago, I think two other states have now adopted, and Oregon could become the third, but there may be some competition with that bill, too. But I also bring this forward because in rural Oregon, we have very few psychologists, and I have no psychiatrists that practice in my district. I think I've got one that lives in Baker County and maybe out of practice at this time, two that live in Union County but not in my district. They say you have to be crazy to live somewhere over there, but anyway.
And that's why you need psychiatrists.
The psychiatrists that we have that service Malheur County are at a distance, and we do have a psychiatric nurse practitioner that lives in Idaho that does come over and help us in our mental health clinic on a regular basis. So I just had one question, Elizabeth, with your background on this. Do we know how many psychologists there are in that are presently practicing in rural distressed areas of the state?
Chairman Butler, the Office of Rural Health, I talked with them this morning, and they said they would try to look into that. I think they may be able to get from the board that actually certifies these psychiatrists, get a listing or something by county. So they may be able to look into that more closely. But as of today, they didn't have any information.
Damiana Weather, Mary Weather is here from the Oregon Psychological Association. And I told you we'd limit this to people with broken legs.
Yeah, orthopedic surgeons.
Very graceful today, Chair. Thank you. We are happy to defer our testimony on this bill to allow the committee up for the record. My name is Damiana Merriweather here on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association. We're happy to defer our testimony. Based on my conversations with the Office of Rural Health and the data they have, as of a couple of months ago, 126 psychologists statewide would have qualified under that criteria. I know one of the discussions that we've also had are that there are management tools at the disposal of the Office of Rural Health that they can further limit who would qualify beyond just the basic delimiter of what is designated rural areas. They do that with focusing on frontier counties, those sorts of things. So there are other management tools there, too, that allow to control some of the cost factors and really focus that on the areas of the greatest need so that we address what sometimes arises concerns about providing unnecessary assistance in some communities.
Okay, thank you, Damiana.
Can I ask this one question?
Yes,
but this bill doesn't narrow it to the frontier counties.
No, it does not.
So it's just by rule that they would
correct.
Determine how much they want to limit it.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And I do have one psychologist, PhD psychologist, in my area. Yes, Representative.
So when we say by rule, then if this bill were to pass, then the Office of Rural Health could limit it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, my understanding is that there are some latitudes within the Office of Rural Health jurisdiction over the statute that allow them to place certain limitations and management tools, which they have done with some of the other profession groups within the parameters of the statute. I'm not deeply versed on them, I'll tell you, but that's my understanding.
Damiana, will you give us some information relative to what would happen if we limited the scope of this way down to just those frontier counties? And I think there's about 10 frontier counties in the state with populations of 5.5 or less per square mile. So if you'd give us that, and incidentally, that's mostly southern and eastern Oregon. Representative Boquist, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the definition of frontier counties, but what strikes me on this right here is something that we've faced on veterans, and that is that we have a whole host of rural units that are now being deployed to overseas, and one of the huge things that we know is going to be unmet, and we're not going to be able to fund it to figure it out, is the mental health issues that are going to come up from a large portion of those that when they come back. And we're talking about places like Burns and Lakeview and
maybe Ontario.
Ontario,
Brother.
Exactly, Ontario.
Yeah,
and what we have found interesting enough this morning is that believe it or not, Pendleton is a major, we have a major health crisis in Pendleton in regards to treating veterans, because no one wants to step up to the plate. And so I think, you know, I don't know what frontier counties are defined as, but it seems to me this might be...
I think all of the counties that surround Umatilla County are frontier counties represented, in my recollection. But I believe it's 5.5 or less per square mile population. Representative Hass is recognized?
Yes, I'm not sure who this question can be answered by, but I was wondering why the decision to place us at 09.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, the good sponsor of my bill, Representative Butler, suggested that that would be a way to ease us into introducing this without having an immediate heavy fiscal burden, something we could ramp up to. It would also be something that we could use as a tool communicating with psychologists who are coming out of the graduate programs in Oregon that this is something that's out there that could retain those graduates when they graduate and entice them to move into those rural communities, but with a ramp up in the fiscal impact.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I appreciate not wanting to put a burden on this budget cycle, but we keep seeing this, and I frankly would be more supportive of these bills if it was in this budget. I mean, if it's a good idea and we can afford it, we should do it now. I'm sure this is starting to sound like a broken record, but if we can't afford it now, then let's do it in 07 or 09 when perhaps we can. I mean, I just think that's kind of straightforward, and I'm not going to sound self-righteous about this because I've been part of this same decision-making process where I encourage people to do the same thing, but I mean, at some point, I think we need to be a little more honest with ourselves.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Boquist, and then Representative
Compton. Just to that, and then Mr. Chair, I mean, I don't broke the record back on the veterans issue, but I mean, we do have we've got a serious mental health problem coming on the veterans issue. And I mean, I'd be one and willing to bite the bullet earlier on this.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Compton?
For the record, I'd also strongly lean in on earlier implementation date. I don't know what you have in rural counties for health care, for mental health care, but if Representative Boquist thinks veterans have a problem, what do you think we have in middle school? We do not have the psychologists and mental health people that we need in schools, and this would just be a benefit for all of us.
Thank you very much, Representative Compton. This does follow, again, as Ms. Merriweather has indicated, it follows a trend to try and attract those folks out as they're in college, to bring them to the rural areas of the state to let them know that there are these opportunities as they're coming through their last years of university. So this is intended to be an attraction for those folks that are considering, that may be practicing or that may be coming out of school with a undergraduate degree to work towards a graduate degree of a PhD towards coming back to rural Oregon. So.
Of course, that happens very well at Lewis and Clark College.
Yep, thank you. And would you bring us some numbers on the rural counties of those 126 potential, Damiana, so that we might even be able to consider that again?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. And for the record, we'd be more than happy to do this sooner rather than later, too.
I know you would. Thank you very much. We've got a 12.393 budget agreement that we've got to hold to as well. Thank you, Damiana. Any further questions? At this time, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2514 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2787. Elizabeth?
So with House Bill 2787, this is very similar to the bill you just heard, except for this is adding certified emergency medical technicians to the list of rural medical providers who can qualify for that rural medical providers tax. Again, it's allowing the Office of Rural Health to identify the rural area for which the emergency medical technician services qualifies a technician for the tax credit. This one applies beginning on or after January 1st, 2006, so this begins 3 years sooner. It allows the Office of Rural Health to establish then the criteria for certifying individuals as eligible, and then again, one option could be those frontier counties, but it's not restricted to be that in the bill. Again, I was talking with someone from the Office of Rural Health. They thought they were getting some numbers on this
But then I never saw him. So.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Question, Representative.
Yeah, that was my question, Elizabeth. I don't get this going in my packet.
Yeah, no, I haven't done these. I just, you know, I've got to get some information about where these people are located, and Office of Rural Health in the past has done that.
Representative, follow up, or Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, I mean, this is an assistance credit, but we're targeting emergency medical technicians. This is similar. Didn't we do a tax credit? Didn't the committee do something with emergency medical technicians earlier?
Right. We had a bill. Yeah, the expenses. We had that bill dealing with it, above the line deduction kind of thing. But no, we didn't move it. I mean, we just heard it once. Yeah.
Extending the sunset of the credit.
No, I mean it was the day you were gone.
No.
Yeah, it was
Warner.
It was one of your bills.
No.
We passed a lot of bills that day.
I wondered what happened to my schedule. Okay.
No, it was one that you sponsored, but we heard it on the day you couldn't make it, and so
okay. Yeah.
But it was dealing with the expenses of emergency medical technicians.
Yeah, and there is an amendment representing.
Oh yeah, you do have a -1 amendment, which I haven't. This was just brought here this morning, or this. At the meeting, and it's for pharmacists, it looks like. So this would be adding pharmacists to the list of those who would qualify for the rural medical provider tax. So imagine there's someone here who will speak to this.
Or is that the bill?
Thank you. Further questions of staff? Tom Holt has signed up, and we'll just move that over, Tom, or do you need to speak today? I've got other folks ahead, and we are scheduled for a later time on this, Tom, so if that's okay, you're here in the building, so we'll go ahead. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2787.
And 85. 80.
No. 87.
2787.
Oh, sorry.
I don't know.
Tom, we'll hold your name as well as Damiana and Robert Lundback over on those two bills. And we'll the final one that we've got for public hearing, 3348. We'll open the public hearing on 3348.
Okay. So with House Bill 3348, this is a change as far as increasing the annual maximum cap of the rural medical provider tax credit to $10,000 beginning tax year 2006 and beyond. Then it indexes that annual cap to changes in inflation beginning tax year 2007. So this was one that basically under current law, the cap is at $5,000, and so then we're doubling that. And so I was able to get the Office of Rural Health and the Department of Revenue's tax data sets merged, and then the Department of Revenue was able to then give us some understanding of those taxpayers who are claiming the rural medical credit, how much additional tax liability do they have. So basically that's what you are seeing there in this one page. I gave you a one-page summary, basically, of statistics on the rural medical tax credit, but this basically became the basis then for the revenue impact for the bill. And what you can see is that the amount claimed, there was some, this is tax year 2003, the amount claimed was $7.1 million, but the actual amount that was used was $6.6 million. For these rural medical providers. But you can see the amount of tax they still owed and the amount they had was $9.7 million basically remaining of tax liability. So that's what you're getting at, is then going up an additional $5,000 for each provider if they have sufficient tax liability in order to be able to claim that. So that's basically what I went through and examined. And so the revenue loss beginning in 2005-06, which would just be a portion of the 06 tax liability, would be $4 million, and then by 2006-07, $5 million, and then so roughly about $10 million a biennium for this additional increase in the cap to $10,000. Now, obviously, if you start adding additional providers, and then you also have a bill like House Bill 3348 passed, then it doubles all the revenue impacts that you would be seeing on the other bills. So just keep that in mind.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
I don't know what testimony you have, Mr. Chair, but I'm curious, Elizabeth, when was this rural health tax credit implemented, and do we have anything that points us to, you know,
how it's working.
Well, yeah, you know, in your background here, it was enacted, the credit was enacted in 1989, okay, so it's...
And do we have anecdotal, or has there been any study that says doctor, I mean, we can see who's using it, but is there anything that says that some decision point is made by a doctor based on this to go to someplace that... Do you understand my question?
Sure.
I'm looking for something, yeah, if it's out there. And for future testifiers, then are on record that's sort of a question that I have.
And we did not have anyone sign up on this bill. However, we tried to discourage folks from signing up today because we are going to carry this over until Monday. And with the credit 16 years old, that was why when the folks from the rural health care providers came to me with it, they said 16 years ago a $5,000 credit would be worth $10 a day, that's where that would take us. So,
yeah.
Other questions? Representative Galizio is recognized.
Yeah, I have an anecdotal. I know someone very well as a family nurse practitioner.
Yeah.
And this person was attracted to a rural area primarily because of the loan reimbursement, which was a federal program, because that was...
This isn't the health care provider that you married, is it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I thought
so. The loan reimbursement, which is more significant, much more significant than this, was a clear incentive. We didn't even know about this $5,000 rural credit, that it existed. Neither did our accountant at the time. So it had no bearing whatsoever as far as... But the loan repayment at the federal level, now that was significant, and that was an incentive.
So your wife practices in the rural area of the state?
Yeah, Mo'ala. Not a frontier area as far as I know.
Did you fire your accountant?
Well, I'm trying to get the chair, but he lives so far away.
Thank you very much. No further testimony on House Bill 3348. We'll go ahead and close the hearing on 3348. Let's see. We'll take this first one out of order. The work session on 2338. Representative Crummell is here, and so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2338. Representative Crummell, welcome. Thank you. We're honored to have you here. We know you've got a busy schedule. Thank you for waiting while we went through that other process.
No problem, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for having a work session on House Bill 2338. I would just point out that behind me here are some Chamber of Commerce members, so they're from the Hillsborough area,
welcome.
And they're kind of watching the process to see this happen. So if I'm their state rep, which I border on Hillsborough, then they get to see both Representative Hass and I and Representative Riley and everyone in action. So this is good. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2338 was before you a couple of weeks ago, and based on some comments that were made from the dais and then and some other conversations had, I have asked Legislative Council to draft some amendments. So you should have, hopefully, before you a -1 amendment for House Bill 2338. You'll remember that this is a bill for high-growth school districts, and it creates a high-growth grant. And it would give a school district, in the original form, would give the school district a $2 million grant for their growth. We have, with the -1 amendments, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have changed this a little bit. First thing that we did is that we created on page 1 after line 28, we're creating a section 8. And it is an amount, a bucket of money, if you will, in the amount of not to exceed $10 million in any biennium. And if the total amount needed to help high-growth school districts exceeds that limitation at the formula below, then it would then the Department of Education would prorate the money as opposed to following the formula that we've noted. And then on page 4, lines, we're deleting the lines that we have in there about the high growth grant and the triggers, and replacing it with that the high growth grant would be equal to $1,000 per times the ADM of the school district minus the district for the previous year. That's where your growth is coming in. And there, a school district is going to get this high growth grant if in the prior two fiscal years, so you're actually looking at a three-year window, in the prior two fiscal years, the district had a growth in ADM. And I notice that this is not on, based on weighted. This is actual bodies that are showing up at the door is what it's based on. A growth in ADM of 3% or more over the previous fiscal year, and that the growth is of at least 90 students or more over the previous year. I did that because we wanted to base this on actual bodies showing up, as I mentioned before. The other thing is that the number 90, if you have, generally speaking, we have about 30 students per class, that's three additional classes. So that, and that's really why we came up with the, with 90. And then also, because it's prorated, schools with high growth will still get a bump. But it's not going to. It just wouldn't be the full $1,000 if it was going to take more than $10 million to cover all of the growth. I think that $10 million is a sufficient size. But for example, school districts like Beaverton, which was just in the paper the other day, that they're now going looking at the board is going to go out for a bond of $150 million to build some new schools, so that they're ready in 2015. When more students are expected to be there than are there today. And we all know that in the 90s, Hillsborough, for example, was growing by 4 and 5% per year. We're faced with that now in Sherwood. They're expected to grow 6%. We know Salem is growing. We know we've got a number of Bend and Lapine area. Tigard is growing. So we've got a number of areas of the state that are growing. And I think that this is a good way to help those schools deal with some of that growth. So, Mr. Chair, I would ask that you adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2338, and then I would ask that you, I believe it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does indeed.
And staff is shaking their head or nodding their head, and so I would ask that you then move it to send the bill to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Crummell. Maybe we could just have a couple of questions of staff. Steve, the high growth areas, moving that to a 3% or more over the previous fiscal year, that ADM growth, do we know how many schools now? Previously we were working with Sherwood only.
Correct. I tried to come up with some numbers quickly this morning because I didn't have the amendments until late yesterday. And in doing the numbers, I misread the amendment that they had to meet the test for 3 years, for three consecutive years. And I just ran my numbers based upon this last year, comparing 04-05 to 05-06. And with just that restriction, there was 12 districts that would qualify.
12 in one year.
Right. And the dollars was just over $5 million. That would be for that high growth grant at $1,000 per student.
Okay.
Now, with adding two more years to the 3% growth and 90 student minimum, would reduce that 12 to, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9, and reduce the amount probably to a little bit under $5 million for that first year.
Representative Crummell, do you know how many districts now qualify under this version?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. But I believe that Steve is pretty accurate in his numbers based on where we have seen the growth and school districts that have been in the news where we have seen the growth occurring.
Okay, so it could be as many as 8 or 9 districts, perhaps over the 3% over the 4 years.
Over 3 years.
Three years, correct. Yeah, but starting with the first year to get to the second year to get your first 3%.
As I read it, they have to meet the test in all 3 years, consecutive years.
Yes, that is correct. So they would have 3% growth, and it was the you'll remember, Mr. Chair, the original bill was 4% growth in the five previous fiscal years. What we've done is we've backed that off to 3 years and dropped it down to 3% growth because. And then we added also the number of 90. I think that answers, you know, if you have a situation where you've got a school district that has 35 students, no offense, Mr. Chair, and a couple of large families move in, and they've met the test, and that happens 3 years in a row, that they, you know, but they might also need that. But they, but the other side to it is a school district like Beaverton that has 45,000 students, and you know, when they get when they're seeing 3% is 800 or 900 students, that's a whole school. And so we need to be able to accommodate that, and so that's why we worked on these numbers to make sure that we would be able to help school districts that are going to be in those kinds of situations.
And I appreciate you bringing that up, that line 15 of the dash one amendment, which indicates there's got to be 90 or more over that, because I've done the calculation at Diamond and Juntura that all we had to do was just add 0.3 in each of the years, you know, so I get a family move in and they would qualify for big time. But using both the ratio and then using 90 or more ADM. Steve?
Mr. Chair, yes, the combination of those two means that no districts having less than 3,000 students would qualify. Regardless of, yeah.
Right. And I understand that, and you know, we can always see how this works, and if it seems to work, you know, I guess we go from there, but I think that this is a way for some of these districts that are really being stretched for them to get a little bit of a bump. But remember that it's also not for every student in the district. It's the $1,000 bump for the number over the previous year.
Excellent.
So that's where the growth factor comes in.
Representative Hassan, unless my memory doesn't serve me correctly, this would affect some of your school districts, wouldn't it?
Well, Beaverton is the fastest growing school district in the last decade in terms of sheer number of students growing by 800.
And 3 years at 3%?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so. And certainly over 90 students. So.
Yeah. And we're you know, about a school and a half a year is what we're building. And you know, you heard Representative Kremel speak about the bond levy that it's coming up.
Right. And this would come out of the formula. It would come out of the state school funding for you. Get cut before the rest of the state school funding is divvied up.
Mr. Chair, yes, it would mean a reduction in the general purpose grant to compensate for the high growth grant.
Representative Boquist is recognized.
I just had a question. You mentioned somewhere between 9 and 12 districts would be impacted, and this is for staff. What's your recollection? Are we still going to see a formula that shows us that's in the present growth in the present school year? Now, a year from now, how many school districts would be in line or could potentially, if they saw a growth rate, step into that same category?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, what I'm comparing is the estimated numbers of ADM for 05-06 compared to 04-05, so that's the first year, rough estimate. Second year, I would expect similar numbers.
Because we know, I guess my point is, we know some of these districts are continuing to grow. I mean, they're building houses now, which means kids are going to come. So, I mean, there's a 2 or 3 year effect here in doing this. So that's what I was kind of looking for, the revenue impact over that, or the fiscal impact over that.
And that was, if I may, Mr. Chair, that was one of the reasons why we tried to make the size of the amount, the $10 million, or not to exceed $10 million, so that it would cover you know, for a 2 to 3 year period. As staff has mentioned, it would be about, and I don't remember, Steve, if you said it was $5 million a year or $5 million a biennium.
$5 million a year.
A year. So the $10 million for the biennium would be is just about right.
Thank you. We are in work session. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, with gratitude to Representative Crummell, when we first heard this, there was a lot of problems that I had around the sort of wide open nation of it, and knowing that I had very great sympathy for high growth districts living in one, and also understanding some of the issues of the Sherwood District. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2338.
You heard the motion. Representative Berger moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 427 to House Bill 2338. Your motion?
Well, I think I spoke.
Self-explanatory.
Yeah, I like the sideboards that have been put on this and the maximum cap, which needed to happen to, for yeah, my...
Thank you. Excellent. Further discussion relative to the motion. Representative Comp is recognized.
Using our typical protocols to the bill, I have concerns about the bill, and it's a foundational point. I've talked to a number of people in this legislature since I began here on the fact that average daily membership, and I'm going to try to refrain from getting agitated and excited because Representative Esquivel tries to keep me contained over here.
As representative, in all seriousness, I'm going to say that you're a person because of your being a superintendent in one of these schools, you know.
Well, so. Principal.
Or principal, I beg your pardon.
Yeah. But average daily membership doesn't have a hill of beans to do with how many kids are in a classroom. Until we take average daily attendance, will we know how many buildings we need and how many classrooms. Is there a way to do that when we look at the funding formula? Yeah. The figures that we get do not tell you how many students are for the funding formula, do not tell you how many students are in a classroom and how many classrooms we need. It's a major flaw.
Is there a reporting method that gives us the actual attendance?
If the Oregon Department of Education wants it, yes.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in statute, it's not there right now. It's average daily.
ADM or ADMW.
ADM or ADMW. And in all regards and best respects to growing districts, and I'm in a growing district, you know, you have to do this calculation and you do it the best you can. And I don't like modulars any more than anybody else. But we have a basic issue here that I'm going to have a tough time voting for any bill that's connected to the ADM formula.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel is recognized.
So on a daily basis, does not the teacher take attendance every day? And isn't that compiled
most times,
on a daily basis?
Several times a day.
And it's substantially different than what you're saying. We're comparing an apple and an orange. Is that what
yep.
you're saying?
On their attendance sheet, on their class enrollment, it has that there's 28 students enrolled in this class, or 32. And you need another classroom if you're going to have 30 more kids. But on a daily attendance, there's probably at the most 25 students in that class.
Thank you. Representative Hass is recognized.
I'm sympathetic to Representative Kahn's argument. This bill, though, you know, is kind of doesn't deal with that concern one way or the other, and you can't. This isn't probably the appropriate bill to try to deal with it. So.
Point taken.
Thank you, Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little uncomfortable with this bill right now. Because I really don't know what this amendment does, because no one has really gone through and seen, you know, how many schools, where they are, who they are, and what it's going to cost. Nobody's actually done that, because staff read the amendment wrong. And I would like to not pursue this today because I don't know the answers.
Steve, how far are we away from obtaining the answers? Let's see. Today is Thursday.
I could probably have it tomorrow.
And the closest that we could hear it would be Monday. We could post.
Mr. Chair, it's on the agenda for tomorrow.
For tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Point well taken. Representative Boquist and then Representative Hass. Representative Boquist, recognized.
Mr. Chair, for the sake of time, I'm not there either yet.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hass is recognized.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to suggest that perhaps we could adopt the amendment. And since this doesn't technically have any fiscal to it, we could explore the possibility of rescinding the referral to Ways and Means, which would then give us the time to spend an extra day or two looking at this bill.
Actually, that would probably, because it does have a fiscal...
Doesn't it just change the... Is there an appropriation here?
No, there is no appropriation.
It has an effect on the state school fund.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Technically, whatever's.
We've got another day to get counsel on that, Representative Hass. Let's follow up. The motion on the floor is to pass the dash one amendment. If you're uncomfortable with that, we'll still go ahead and take that vote right now. But we will bring this back for a work session. And I intend to go ahead and entertain that motion at this time. So the motion is House Bill 2338-1 amendment be appended, dated 4/27/05, and the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
No.
Representative Felicio.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair House.
Aye.
And Chair Butler.
Chair Butler votes aye. The dash one is appended to House Bill 2338, with that, colleagues, we've got this posted for tomorrow. We'll carry this over till tomorrow. At that particular point, we'll close. And Representative Cromwell, your work is cut out for you, it looks like.
Looks like it.
And looking at the amounts that just from Steve's first run on the 1 year, you're down from $2 million to $253,500. However, Beaverton 48J is up to $1,638,000. So, looks like you lose, he wins. So
did Representative Hass do the math on that, or what?
Thank you very much, Representative. We'll close the work session on 2338. And Steve, while I've got you here, I think I'll just go ahead. Let's see, I have you for 2450. So we'll go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2450. Steve?
Did you close it?
Did I close it? I thought I did. Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2450, you had a public hearing on already. This bill deals with the high-cost disability grant and the school equalization formula. As you recall from the testimony, when it was passed last session, there was a sunset put on it so that it would only last 2 years without additional legislative action. So what the 2450 is doing is repealing that July 1, 2005 sunset date for the high-cost disability grant and also for the small high school supplement fund. The grant currently is for high-cost disability costs above the $25,000 per student, and that is maintained. But the grant is still limited to $12 million per year. The Small High School Supplement Fund has been at $2.5 million per year, would stay that in the bill, and that is distributed proportional to the average daily membership of those small high schools. The revenue impact indicates then that $12 million would be shifted basically from all districts to districts with high-cost students. And that would be about an $18 per weighted student reduction. The high-cost districts that qualify would be about 96 districts, and they would gain roughly $5,900 per high-cost student whose costs were above that $25,000 threshold, or about $22 per weighted student for those 96 districts. And then the $2.4 million in the Small High School Supplement Fund is about $4 per weighted student for all districts, and 102 districts would qualify for an average of $162 per small high school student. And then there would be a minor shift from education service districts to school districts because of the 95 school 5% ESD split. You have a dash 2 amendment. And the only difference between House Bill 2450 and the Dash 2 Amendment is the threshold for the high-cost disability students. That substitutes $30,000 per student for the $25,000 that's in the bill. So it would only apply to those high costs above the $30,000 for each of those students.
Well, Steve, I think your prior testimony on this had been that the maturity of this had basically been expended between 25 and 30,000. At 70%, wasn't it?
At the $25,000 level, the total eligible cost was $17.7 million, but it had to be limited to 12. So right. Each district's amount was prorated down by the same percentage.
Okay.
At the 30,000 threshold level, the total cost using, again, 03-04 data is about $10 million, and that would be a reduction then of $15 per weighted student for all districts. 80 districts would qualify for the high-cost grant, and that would be at about $9,500 for a high-cost disability student, or $19 per weighted student for those 80 districts. There is also a Dash 5 amendment. The Dash 5 has the $30,000 in it, just like the Dash 2. What the Dash 5 adds is language that says to qualify or to be eligible, a district has to spend for special education costs on all of their IEP students at least as much as they are getting in revenue from the formula for those IEP students, based upon the value of the general purpose grant per weighted student. So if they're not spending at least that much, then they would not qualify for the high-cost disability grant. And I have some idea perhaps of the number of districts that might not qualify. It could be 10 to 15 districts. The information is incomplete right now. But again, I have no idea how many of those 10 or 15 districts would change their behavior or their spending or their accounting coding to then qualify. So all of them could potentially qualify.
We heard that snicker on the tape, Representative.
Sorry, Chairman.
Representative Com.
I just appreciate our administrative services, because Steve's been around the block more than once, and he speaks with high accuracy in what happens. So, thanks, Steve.
You're welcome. You do have two tables, one for the bill, 2450, and then you have a table for the Dash 2, and then again, I didn't make a separate one for the Dash 5, again, because potentially all districts could qualify, and I'm not sure which ones won't.
Mr. Chair. President Berger?
Could I ask Steve to go through the Dash 5s again? I didn't quite get it the first time through. What does it say? That this district must spend what?
It has to spend on all of its IEP students.
All
not just the high cost, all of them.
All of them.
As much as it's receiving in formula revenue for that extra weight.
Okay. So, Steve, this would require some calculations at the... How does this work on the ground? They would do some calculations, or the ODE would do the calculations and then distribute? How would that work?
The Department of Education would have to calculate what those revenue amounts were. Mm-hmm. They would have to calculate or get data from the districts on what their expenditures were. For, again, it references, I believe, approved costs. Mm-hmm. Do a comparison and see if they are spending at least as much as the formula revenue generated by that extra weight for those IEP students.
Okay. Now, that's for... Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
That's for... If I'm getting this... And that number would be compared to what they qualify for under the high-cost disability, or what they might actually get under the high-cost disability?
No, it's not directly related to the high-cost. It says, do they qualify for the high-cost disability grant, or do they not?
Okay.
Not how much the high-cost disability grant
is. So it's a yes or no, up or down. It isn't a comparison to the... It's a comparison to the amount they're spending on their high-cost students compared to
All of their IEP students.
All of their... Compared to what they would get, what the weighting in the...
That extra one weight for being an IEP student and that additional $5,000+.
Okay, and do you don't have a run for how many? I mean, you have no way of how many would qualify or not, or.
Well, I'm saying the incomplete data that I have would indicate, you know, maybe 10 or 15 would not qualify for the high cost grant because of that. From the 80 or 96 districts, depending on whether it's $25,000 or $30,000.
Okay.
Representative?
No, let me think on this for a minute,
okay.
And I'll come back.
This is complex. Representative Pass is recognized.
Thank you. Question for Stephen. Curious more than anything else, I'm sure there's an easy explanation as to why some of these cities have zeros in the high-cost formula that don't seem like, you know, tiny towns like Astoria.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pass, I assume that they have a high-cost student that meets that $25,000 cost threshold. That's they've reported one or more students that meet that test.
Question, staff, to Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Boquist.
In the same category, same line of questioning, is that a zero? If I understand the program correctly, hypothetically, I mean, a school district has to file to get the grant, correct?
Correct.
So there may, in fact, be a follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Then there may, in fact, be districts that may or may not qualify, but they haven't filed into the grant program to get the funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, let me take that back. They have to report to the Department of Education. If they have one of these students, they won't have to necessarily file an application, but the department will ask for that information from the district.
And Representative Boquist, I apologize. You had sent me a note that you were preparing on April 14th, that you were preparing, asking for an amendment to this bill, and I didn't receive a copy of that, but we've now received a copy of that amendment. That's a -3 amendment. Can you just explain your -3 amendment, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not following up, but I mean, the -3 amendment, I'm sorry, is really very, very simple, and that is it goes back to the original bill, $2,450, and it increases the grant amount of the total funds available from $12 million to $18 million, which means we would fund 100% of the program versus scaling back as we're proposing these amendments. It's very simple.
Okay, Steve, in moving that up to $18 million and considering the -2 amendment that moves the threshold or the deductible, if you will, to $30,000, is what's the likelihood that we'll expend $18 million at the $30,000 threshold?
Mr. Chair, with the $30,000 threshold just being at about $10 million now, it would take us several years, I would think, to get to $18 million.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there a provision for the excess that's set aside out of the formula?
If it's not used, then it would stay in the formula and be used for a general purpose grant.
Okay. Representative Boquist?
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. If you go back to the original simulation run for $2,450, eligible costs are $17.05 million. In the present model that we utilize, which is the year we're in now.
That's with the $25,000 deductible.
That's with $25,000 deductible. So, without running it on a spreadsheet, it's fairly easy to assume that if the eligible costs today are $17 million, that of the $18 million mark, if it were amended and went to $18 million under existing program, that virtually 100% of that $18 million would be used up in the next biennium.
That would make the dash two amendment unnecessary based upon the consideration of dash three. Representative Riley is recognized.
I just wondered if staff agrees with that, with what Representative Burke was saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, yes. I mean, if $18 million would be sufficient to fully fund at the $25,000 initially. Keep in mind, though, that all of these numbers are based upon 03-04 data, and those numbers will increase a little bit before 05-06.
So what you've got is you've got an obvious hydraulic here. The dash 2 moving it to $30,000, increasing the deductible. The $12 million is sufficient. The dash 3, without the dash 2, then the hydraulic is that the deductible would not be increased from $25,000 to $30,000, and that the folks would then have a larger amount out of the formula to expend. Is that right, Steve?
Correct.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist, recognized?
My rationale is really, well, first off, I don't need to declare a conflict of interest because every one of my schools is in this category. So, but the fact of the matter is if the program's a good program, and nobody debated whether it was a good program or a bad program, we just debated how do we pay for it. So therefore, the debate is, do we move the threshold up to $30,000 and just expend $12 million like we did last time, or, and that's a percentage of a program, or do we just fund the whole program? If it's a good program, let's fund it. And that's all my amendment does. It says we're going to move the amount up.
Thank you, Representative Booker. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you. I would never argue that it would be the wrong thing to do, but we have to remember we're just dealing with existing money. We're not
right.
adding
exactly.
any more money. And this argument over special needs is no different than the argument over high growth or, for that matter, changing the formula for kindergarten. We're not. If we put in more money into special education, we're taking it from somewhere else. And that's kind of the thing that I always keep in my mind. Until we add more money, I agree, we should add more money to fully fund this program. But if we do it only within the formula, we're adding more money at the expense of other programs. And I mean, you can say that about any one of these that we all care about, whether it's kindergarten, high growth. That there's just winners and losers when we just mess with the formula and don't add additional money.
President Comp, I'm ready to take some counsel from you at this point. Is your school? How does this affect your school? Moving it to $25,000 from $25,000 to $30,000.
I was waiting for somebody else to take the lead on this.
I guess I'm anxious as I look down. Typically in rural Oregon, we have not. The comment earlier on down in legislative revenue was that typically the more metropolitan areas have the higher need students for some reason. We don't have the numbers that congregate in rural Oregon. We don't have the facilities to handle some of these super high-need students. We don't have the medical facilities that are close at hand. So I guess when I look at that, I say, wait a minute, I'd rather keep it at 12 rather than 18. But I also look at it and say, from the testimony that we had, that we could move up the deductible and keep the price at $12 million and continue to do good things without damaging really any school district. So I'm still anxious in that regard.
And I think you're reading it right, because I was really, I could accept, the dash two amendments. And then when, because we do need the support in this program. That's all there is to it, and it's how we're going to do it.
And Representative Hass's comment was at that particular point, because we're not creating any new dollars.
Exactly.
With the dash two amendment, You're basically saying this with the dash two, by moving it to $5,000, then the $12 million should be relatively close to being sufficient.
Well, and I can't calculate that fast, but we do. Yeah, the dash three seems really like a rosy idea, and I like it, but I don't know who's going to get hurt by it, and that's why I'm kind of. I would just assume go with the dash two. But
thank you, Representative. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Frankly, in the districts I'm seeing, Mr. Chair, that I have, we're seeing the exact opposite. And I think the statistical fact is we're seeing huge metropolitan districts go down in size. And they're moving to Sherwood. They're moving out into Beaverton and other places. And you're seeing growth out there. My district is seeing the exact opposite. Harrisburg is a prime example. Well, what you have is the people that were living in Eugene and elsewhere are now moving out to smaller districts because they see better service in the smaller districts for smaller kids. And so we're having districts
with the high-cost disability students.
Yeah. I mean, I got several of my districts. I got a handful of my districts where people are actually moving out into, you know, urban areas, and that's got to do, frankly, not, you know, maybe with education and more to do with the cost of housing is less expensive in those areas now, and they're moving out, and the interest rate is low, and they bought a house, and they're moving out there. And so I have districts now looking this year in enrollment as we speak right now, and then next year looking at enrollment of increasing high-need students. So,
Yes, Representative Galuzzi.
I wonder if it would be helpful in terms of the dash two versus dash three to hear maybe from Mr. Marshall or Mr. Bennett, or
if either of them are prepared to speak, I would invite them to come forward. Lori, you're looking a little antsy too. I didn't know whether that was just Chuck needling you from the back or just what.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. What we're dealing with here in the high-cost disabilities grant is an insurance risk pool. Every school district in the state makes a premium payment because you're taking money out of the state school fund, and therefore that affects every student in the state or every school district in the state to the extent of about $18 per weighted student. So every school district is paying its premium in order to enjoy the benefits should they need the insurance pool. The issue at hand is the deductible. At $25,000, a school district that has a claim, if you will, over that $25,000 is going to get about 70% of that reimbursed. If you, as the Dash 2 amendments suggest, you increase the deductible, then the portion of reimbursement for the amount in excess will go up without changing the premium. The dash the dash 3 amendments, in effect, will increase the premium for every school district and leave the deductible where it is, and thereby increase the amount of the reimbursement. So what we're arguing about, I believe, is what's an appropriate level of premium, how big should the deductible be in order to create a reimbursement out the other end. And some work done by the Department of Education, which we support, are the Dash 2 amendments, which leave the amount of the premium the same. They increase the deductible so that those school districts that have the extraordinarily high cost of students with disabilities and are providing services to those students will receive a higher portion of those excess costs reimbursed. It will be 100%. So you can see the hydraulic at work.
Thank you.
We're not interested, frankly, in increasing the premium in this environment. But we would like to see more school districts be able to benefit from those extraordinary high-cost students by receiving a greater portion of those excess costs reimbursed. In short, Mr. Chair, we think the Dash 2 amendments are a good idea.
Thank you very much. Lori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And well, committee members, for the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, and we were happy with the bill as written, and we would also support the Dash 2. I think the analogy to health care pooling is a good one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of these two folks? Irfane Boquist?
Yes. You spotted a dynamic. We could just pass the bill as it was originally written. So that's
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to make a motion right now. I'm going to leave that to somebody else. But I would like to speak to the fact that we had, in the last session, Representative Hess and I remember this discussion, and the decision points around this, knowing that we weren't going to satisfy all needs here. And I really liked Mr. Marshall's insurance analogy, because I think it's very appropriate. And the cost of the premium is an issue because of the hydraulic, as Representative Haas explains it here. My initial, when I first heard this, I frankly thought that the bill is good. It is working as we envisioned it, and that's why there was a sunset there, to come back and say, is this going to work as we envision it? So I'm very satisfied with the original bill, even knowing that it doesn't serve all the needs. And I would really caution all of us, every time Steve runs one of these runs, we all dive to our school districts and analyze it based on that. When we are dealing with the formula, when we are dealing in this arena, we have to be cognizant of all students and the effects that it has. That being said, I look at my district too. Trust me, I'm as guilty as the next person. I would support the Dash 2. To my great colleague, Representative Boquist, I'm not comfortable particularly with raising the premium, if you will. I would also support the original bill. I do think we need to continue with this program, this insurance program, for all of the districts that are impacted, and even the phenomena that you are talking about in your small districts in your rural area, because the impact of one or two students can be huge in a small school. So that's my whole statement on this issue, and I
approve. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. Well, you won't find me saying this much, but I agree with the OEA that the original bill is okay. Or I'd be happy with the Dash 3 that I propose. And I just point out in closing, we can end this discussion whenever, Mr. Chair, is that we are really asking, in an earlier bill, we talked about a $10 million premium, too. We talked about $10 million right off the top. It's a premium, it's a cash premium, whatever you want to do. And that's, of course, all we're doing is rearranging the pie. We all know that.
Yes.
Is all we're doing.
But, we know that.
I mean, I am, for once, in agreement with OEA. I'd be happy with $24.50 or... Well, the only time we're going to agree, right? So.
We also have the Dash 5, and I understand there is someone here from the OEA, Education Department of Education. Nancy?
Either.
Or Brian?
I want to comment on that language.
Yeah, on the language on the Dash 5. Any comments on the Dash 5 language? Okay, I thought it was from them.
It is. It's an amended version of the Dash 1.
Okay. Well, let's come back then to the Dash 2 versus the Dash 3, and we can Representative Comp.
Okay. Chairman Butler, are we going to do the Dash 5? But I was going to move to have the Dash 2, how do you say it?
Append the Dash 2?
Yes.
Okay. The motion is to append the Dash 2 to your motion?
I don't need to speak to it.
Okay.
I think we've all understand it with the analogy for health care.
Okay. The motion is to append the Dash 2 amendment. Mm-hmm. And that is the to increase the in effect the deductible in accordance with the recommendation by John Marshall from OSBA and Lori Wimmer-Whalen from OEA. I'm going to go ahead. Any further discussion on Dash 2? I'm going to go ahead and call for roll call vote on Dash 2.
Representative Boquist.
No.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Galizio.
Aye.
Representative Comp.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
No.
Vice Chair Haas.
Aye.
Chair Butler.
Butler votes aye. We're going to append the Dash 2. to the House Bill 2450. And now we're going to consider the Dash 5 amendment. Brian, and sign in, please.
Chair Butler, Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. My apologies. We had talked about this language earlier, Steve and Nancy and I wasn't aware that it was had become the Dash 5s. It really is a correction to a drafting error. It goes back to the provision that says that in order to qualify for the high-cost disability grant, a district must be expending everything it has gotten through the basic formula for the additional weight for its special education students. The logic of that is if they're not spending what they're getting already, we shouldn't be giving them more. And so the language as originally written said they have to be spending both the extra weight and the original weight, and that was not the intent. The intent was to simply say they must be spending the additional special ed weight before they can qualify for the high cost disability, and that's what the Dash 5s do, is correct that language.
Brian, I'm just a little bit uncomfortable with the paperwork that's required. Can you help us with the paperwork? It sounds like I am sending a whole additional accounting system with regard to these high costs, or with regard to the whole disability and weighting system under the IEP.
Chair Butler, I don't believe the Dash 5s create any more work for districts. The department already collects data through its standard data collection process that gathers expenditure data from school district audits. And we would go to that data to determine whether the districts qualify. This is, creates absolutely no additional work for school districts, and really no additional work for the department either.
So it's information you capture right now today?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Comp?
I move that we append the House Bill 2450 with Dash 5.
The motion is to append 2450 to the Dash 5. Steve?
Just to remind you that the Dash 5 does have the $30,000 in it, so which you've already adopted it in the Dash 2, and you're basically just adding the expenditure
language. Adding that language. Okay. So that has that language in it right now. Yes. Representative Hess?
I'm sure. I was just wondering if, Steve, you agree with that assessment. On the Dash 5.
No, Dash 5. In terms of the data collection?
Yes. I share Chair Butler's concerns about it. And I wanted to get your take.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I agree with Brian that they collect the information. Whether it needs to be tweaked or at all or not, probably not, but there still has to be the comparison done in one way or another.
Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you. I'd like to hear from our school board association again on this. I believe that
John Marshall from OSBA.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon again. John Marshall with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'd like to express some concerns with the Dash 5 amendments. What we have in place is a distribution formula. That is, the dollars go out to school districts based on certain weightings, and then school districts are free to expend those resources based on whatever needs they identify in their school district. We do not have a spending formula. And our concern is that the Dash 5 amendments open that door, and for the first time we are saying school districts, because you receive dollars by virtue of certain weights, then you must spend those dollars on those particular students. And we think that's a crosses a line that we would encourage you not to take.
Thank you, John. Representative Tom?
Give us a peeling of the onion analogy again. So why would we not want to know exactly where our dollars are being directed?
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, I believe that, for example, there is in the state school fund distribution formula a cap on the maximum amount of students that are eligible for the double weighting at 11%.
Correct.
There is a procedure set up inside the Department of Education for school districts to seek a waiver from that cap. There's a committee in place. Those school districts submit applications in order to receive dollars in excess of that cap. In terms of the information that the department needs to allocate these funds, I believe they have the authority to request that. So we don't believe that it's necessary to have this statutory language that dictates, in effect, a spending formula when we have, in fact, a distribution formula. Secondly, these students are being served under an IEP, an Individualized Education Plan. That is a plan that's set up under federal law and rules that where a parent, the student, or a parent, an IEP team in a school district sit down and decide what services that student requires. The cost of those services will be borne by the school district. So I think we have to start from the assumption that if that particular educational program costs, for example, $50,000, one could assume, I think, that they're probably going to be spending that first $10,000 that they get by virtue of that student, or roughly $10,000, the double weighting, by virtue of that student being in the school district on that program.
Representative?
Thank you, Chairman Butler. I'm processing as you speak because...
So am I.
you're dancing well. And I'm not saying that in a negative way because you do understand this process very well. And I want you to go back and restate your first opinion why you don't think we need this and why you think it is going to be a precedent-setting change.
The state school fund distribution formula is just that, a distribution formula.
Correct.
We use weightings to try to identify rational reasons that school districts ought to spend different or ought to be allocated different amounts of money. And we base that primarily on the number of types of students they have.
Correct.
And in order to make that determination, we've come up with different weights to determine how much money an individual school district gets. We base weights on poverty students, students with disabilities, students that don't speak English, etc. The money then, based on those weights, goes to school districts in a pot. And they're then, through their own local budgeting process and board budget adoption, decide how to allocate that money amongst the various competing programs and services within a particular school district. We don't say, well, now you're getting X amount of dollars here because you have pregnant and parenting students. Therefore, you have to spend this carved amount of that money on those particular programs. Nor do we say that you're receiving dollars by virtue of the students you have in your school district that don't speak English. You have to spend exactly this finite amount of money on those students and those particular programs. So we distribute the money and leave it up to local folks to decide how to spend it.
Representative, that's the
mud puddle became very clear after the rain shower.
Okay.
It's interesting that we find ourselves, and particularly myself, in this position because I know that we allocate monies to school districts and then they decide how to expend those monies. I would have never dreamt when I woke up this morning and said my morning prayers, I should have said more of them, that we would be getting to this discussion. I would not like to force this wonderful committee into a decision on this -5 at this time. This is quite a big issue.
Okay.
And I'll put my voice on the record. Nothing would please me more than to have some accountability from school districts that they're spending the money that they're given in appropriated areas. And when Brian said that, I thought, yes, answer to my prayers. But it is a much, much bigger issue that I think everybody on this committee has to understand in depth before I'd be comfortable with moving forward with it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Riley?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Galizio.
I think if we wait until everyone understands everything in depth, it will be the 2009 session. So I would, I mean, not being the chair, I would like to hear Mr. Reeder respond, but I would like to see us vote on the dash five, yay or nay, and continue the process.
Mr. Reeder?
Chair Butler, maybe what I can do is simply give an example here of what the dash fives would do in a particular circumstance without trying to argue one way or the other. To say, for example, that through the extra weights in the formula, a district gets an additional $100,000 for their special education students. And based on their audited expenditure data, we learn that they're only spending $80,000 of that $100,000 actually serving those students. Then they come back to us and say, oh, but we have these other high-cost students, and we would also like another $50,000 for those high-cost students in addition to the $100,000 you've already given us, even though we only spent $80,000 of that $100,000 to serve our existing special education students, including the high-cost ones, by the way. So we haven't spent everything you've given us so far on special education programs, but we're asking you for some more because we have high-cost students. That's what this amendment would prevent from happening. Unless they spend everything you're giving them through the extra weight, then they don't qualify for more through the high-cost program. Now, I would agree with Mr. Marshall that this is a first step towards a spending formula, and the Department of Education does not support a spending formula. We would not agree with going to a wholesale environment where the legislature tells every school district how to spend their money in a great deal of detail. We don't think that's in the best interest of Oregon school children. This bill, admittedly, does just that in a very narrow circumstance.
But Brian, doesn't it also do that right now relative to the transportation grant or the school construction facilities grants? Don't we already do that?
Well, Chair Butler, those grants are really reimbursements, and so they've already spent the money on things they've chosen to spend it on, and then we reimburse them.
But it's,
for
it's
that.
An accountability issue.
Yes, it is. It's an accountability issue.
Okay, Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard from the School Boards Association. I'd like to hear from Lori on this, if we could.
Lori?
For the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen, Oregon Education Association. Thank you for your interest. We, too, have grave concerns about the slippery slope. I acknowledge the accountability concerns that Representative Comp raised. We agree that we'd like to see dollars spent as freely and wisely, and transparency is something that we really support. I don't think this amendment gets us there, however. I think this is, in fact, a dictate from on high about how districts spend their money, and the problem with it for us has to do with flexibility in managing money at the local level. Averages and percentages work only so well to approximate how much money you're delivering to a district, and how they manage within those resources, I think, is really a matter of local control, and that's a preeminent precept for my organization.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Thank you very much. Representative Galizio now moves the dash five amendments.
Representative Comp.
I'm sorry.
I'd like to speak to the motion, if I could.
If you would.
Which is the dash five.
Dash five.
I voted against the dash two amendments because I'm perfectly satisfied with the original bill. I will be voting against this amendment for exactly the same reason. We have waded into waters that was unnecessary that we wade into. I like the original bill, and I'm, for that reason, not supportive of this amendment either.
Thank you. Representative Galizio now moves the question. And the question is to append the dash five. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
No.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah.
Representative Galizio.
No.
Representative Crum.
Five.
Representative Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Haas?
No.
Chair Butler.
Butler votes no. The motion to append to dash 5 fails. With that, we have House Bill 2450, amended by the dash 2 amendments, dash 2 amendments dated 3-21-05. In work session, we continue in work session on that House bill. Representative Berger now moves House Bill 2450 with the dash 2 amendments appended to your motion, Representative.
Since my colleagues like the dash 2, I'm going to support the dash 2 amendment by supporting the bill as amended. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative, and is your motion also relative to any Ways and Means referral?
Absolutely. The referral as, which is a referral to?
Referral to Ways and Means Education.
Okay, then I move House Bill number 2450 to, as amended by the dash 2 amendments to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Now let's see. Let's make sure that we're okay. I'm going to stand.
And I'll be happy.
Let's stand at ease. Let's stand at ease for just a moment. On the record, and colleagues, I want you to know that both House Bills 2450 and 2338 have, by request of the Speaker, a direction from the Speaker, be requested that they do move from this committee to Ways and Means when we get to that particular point. So. The Representative Berger's motion to move House Bill 2450 with the dash 2 appended and as amended with the dash 2 be moved to House Ways and Means to the full Ways and Means is on the table. Discussion of that motion? With a due pass recommendation. Objection to that motion? Okay. Let's have the clerk call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
No.
Representative Esquivel.
He's excused.
I didn't look up. Representative Galicia.
Aye.
Representative Comp.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
And Vice Chair Hess.
Aye.
And Chair Butler.
Chair votes yes. We're going to go ahead and move 2450 as amended with dash amendment to the Ways and Means Committee. Do pass recommendation. Thank you very much. We will close the work session on 2450. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
We'll come back up. 3358, or should we crawl back up? Let's start back up top.
Okay.
We'll open a work session on House Bill 3358 and come back on schedule here. Elizabeth, I think that's you again. I'll bring you up here one more time and put you back to work.
This will be a.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 3358, we heard this just recently, and you do have a dash one amendment. So basically, this is the individual development account issue with creating a personal income tax credit for taxpayers who contribute to an individual development account under certain conditions. It then requires a taxpayer who has contributed to the individual development account to have purchased a primary resident during the tax year and used all or part of the IDA to pay for the settlement, financing, or other closing costs. It specifies that the tax credit is equal to the lesser of the following amounts: either the amount of money that was withdrawn from the IDA for purchase of that resident, or the amount of the reasonable settlement, financing, or other closing costs incurred, up to $2,000. So it's limiting that tax credit to the tax liability of the taxpayer. It does not allow a carry forward of the tax credit. It allows this tax credit for non-residents or part-year residents without proration. It applies to tax years beginning January 1st, 2006. It makes the policy statement, and then you've got your Dash 1 amendment. And your Dash 1 amendment basically is just adding in a policy statement that the state shall provide assistance to lower-income households to help achieve homeownership through these IDAs, individual development accounts, and this new personal income tax credit. It specifies that beginning in on or after July 1st of 2009, that the Legislative Assembly shall appropriate funds, and it doesn't have any blank or anything. It just says, you know, yet to be determined amount in the future legislature, to supplement these individual development account contributions to home acquisition loan down payment requirements and closing costs. Then it repeals that section in the amendment on January 2nd, 2010. So basically, again, with individual development accounts, under current law, a taxpayer can contribute money to an individual development account, as well as there's those matching funds, which we talked about in the last hearing. And those matching funds are coming from a tax credit to people who are contributing to the individual development accounts in order to be able to give these accounts and have low-income taxpayers set up these individual development accounts. But from a taxpayer's perspective, if they contribute monies to the individual development account, they can get a deduction for that under current law. And then as they take a distribution from the individual development account and they purchase a home, then they could have that all be tax-free. That's current law. Then we are going to be allowing with this bill taxpayers to claim both a deduction and a tax credit for the same contributions. And that's what this bill is doing for low-income individuals. And again, this is doesn't have a big revenue loss. The reason why that is because you only have a fixed amount of money that's matching. And they aren't the housing department, which is the one who is works with the fiduciary organizations that set up these individual development accounts, they're limited in the organizations are limited in how much matching money they have from the amount of contributions that they're getting. So that is really what's limiting then this tax credit. So the two tax credits are really kind of linked. In the future, this tax credit can certainly grow. There's a lot of people who might want to take this. This is making individual development accounts more attractive, but they're limited by how much matching money they can get in that fund, which is, again, incented by the corporate tax credit and business tax credit that is allowed for people who contribute to that fund.
Now, is that a tax credit on their part, or is that a tax deduction?
Okay. Are we talking about the one that is
the
corporate one is a tax credit.
Okay. And that's what gives rise to the $23,000 cost, $24,000 cost in 2006,
right.
2007.
And you see these revenue estimates are only based on 75 individual development accounts initially. That would be used with, you know, an average tax liability of $315. So the taxpayers themselves don't have a whole lot of tax liability. I mean, you've got to be low income in order to be able to set up one of these individual development accounts. But the sheer number of people who are in the low income group who would like to purchase a home is actually quite large and much larger than what I've assumed in these revenue impacts. But you're limited, again, by, I got some data from the Housing Department as far as how much they were anticipating would be contributed to the bigger fund, which would then be matching the individual development account contributions by the taxpayers. That's what then is limiting this revenue impact.
Questions of staff?
How do people find out about the IDA?
Well, Representative Galizio, I think, you know, it is something that the Housing Department will talk about with taxpayers and stuff if they call. But really, I don't know if you remember from this is a handout and stuff, but this is what the fiduciary organizations really hand out and kind of help people understand about the program. And so it's just, I think, word of mouth. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we had Janet Jarvis from the Realtors here as well. Representative Galizio,
I'm just wondering, you know, you say 75... Right, mm-hmm. And is there going to be a large attempt to ramp this up so there could be significantly higher numbers?
And I do have growth in this. I mean, I'm growing this out to 200 taxpayers by 2010. And, again, this is based on what I saw as the projections that the Housing Department gave me as far as the amount of matching money that they're, or contributions that they're anticipating coming up.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes, to Representative Galizio's question, this usually gets brought up when we hold first-time homebuyer seminars. It's a freebie. Access happens to put it on in our particular location, Jackson County, and they'll get 50, 100 people into those seminars just so they can understand the steps they must go through in order to purchase a house and what they have to do with their credit and all this stuff, and this will be an integral part of it.
This is part of the probably a first step that you take, because you've got to learn to save, mm-hmm. and then you've got to learn to discipline yourself and then keep your credit clean.
Look at your income to debt ratio.
Do the realtors normally spend some time, extra time in that process with these people?
Usually a realtor does one section, and that is how to select a realtor.
But the bankers...
the bankers are there, the other individuals, the lenders, the mortgage brokers, in fact, they have to even go through a step process where it's a continuing ed for a while until they achieve a certain status.
Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elizabeth, this is for low-income first-time buyers, is that correct? And what's the income level, and that's spelled out somewhere?
Chairman Butler and Representative Riley, in the bill itself, it's not spelled out as far as an income limit, but I think they were saying, 120% of medium income? 80%. Okay, so it's right around median income.
Thank you. And then let me just ask this with regard to the paragraph 2 under section 4 of the dash 1 amendment. With the amounts that the general fund will appropriate and amounts determined by the legislature contemporaneously in 2009, they could appropriate a dollar if they wanted to. That doesn't give them any...
It doesn't bind them to appropriate anything.
Okay. All right. So have you tried to estimate in your...
No.
Haven't done that. Okay.
No.
Well, I know that sometimes they do that they actually do appropriate a dollar to say that is a fund that's worthwhile. We wish we had money to fund it. So with that, colleagues, we are in work session on House Bill 3358. I'm sorry, Representative Hass?
Thank
beg your pardon.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering about these dates on the dash ones. Mm-hmm. Changes beginning
yeah. And Representative Haas, this is just applying to that time period when the future legislature has to look at contributing money. That's all they're beginning with this particular date, beginning on or after January 1st, 2009. So it doesn't have to do with the starting point of this tax credit.
No matching requirement.
No matching requirement. Just said that they have to, examine this and supplement individual development accounts to the home acquisition loan down payments and closing costs, but it doesn't say how much.
If that's done in conjunction with the preamble of Section 4 that defines and declares the policy of the state to provide that assistance to low-income housing to achieve homeownership is the intent of the legislature,
mm-hmm.
I think. And they may allocate more than a dollar, but
And I will say that I haven't gotten this amendment to fiscal yet, but I mean,
Representative Berger?
Yeah, I guess, at the risk of offending the proposer of the amendment, it's again talking about future legislators and a policy statement that I'm a little uncomfortable with, so I'm not going to move that amendment.
Okay.
Anybody else might want?
Representative Hass.
I would move House Bill 3358 to the floor as written.
As written?
Does it have a subsequent referral?
No, it does not.
It has no subsequent referral.
Okay.
To your motion, Representative Hass.
I agree with the representative with his comments.
That we don't need it in statute, that the Legislative Assembly finds and declares that it's the policy of the state to provide assistance to low-income housing. I need this on the record, Tommy.
It's the dates that I think that she and I probably have some concerns about. The first part of that is fine, but I think we're still okay without that.
Okay. You've heard the motion. Any further discussion on the motion to move House Bill 3358 without amendment to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, we will order House Bill 3358 to the House with a due pass recommendation. We will ask Representative Esquivel if he will carry that to the House, please. And colleagues, thank you very much for your work on that. I think that was a housing and real estate coordinated effort to bring that. We will close then the work session on House Bill 3358. Mary, would you like to come up, please? And let's go ahead now with a work session on House Bill 2511. We'll open that work session. Yes, 2511.
Thank you. House Bill 2511 has two amendments to it. The bill essentially would, as amended, would add Amendment 1, would add four additional organizations to the current list of fraternal organizations whose properties are exempt from property tax subject to certain restrictions.
Now, wait a minute. That's in the Dash 1 amendment?
This is the Dash 1 amendment. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is that in the amendment or that's in the bill? That's currently in the bill, Mary. The International Association of Lions Club down on lines 24, 25, 26. Sir Optimus Rotary International Forum.
Correct.
So that's okay.
This is the amendment to the bill just simply does the following thing.
Okay, all right.
It changes certain things in the bill that we presented before.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The amendment 1, version 1, would delete proposed changes to section 1 with the exception of the four additional entities that are defined as fraternal organizations. The section 2, paragraph 3, is also deleted in the amendment dash 1. And that section 2 exempts property tax from owned by fraternal organizations that is used exclusively by charitable organizations that qualify for an exemption from federal income tax because it is an entity described in section 501-3 of the Internal Revenue Code. Previously, when we've brought this before you in the public hearing, there were some issues about section 2, paragraph 3, that basically were confusing, and the amendment deletes that section. There were also some questions about the wording to section 1, whether or not it should include or exclude certain verbiage. Okay, that is the proposed change for Amendment 1. Amendment 2, okay, basically leaves the original bill intact and just deletes Section 2, Paragraph 3. Okay, so now you have a choice between two versions of the bill that basically both of which delete Section 2, which was confusing. And you have a choice, if you will, between version 1 and version 2
version 2 basically leaves everything intact as it was before, originally. Version 1 will delete, will go back to the original language, statutory current law, and just allow four names to be included in the bill. Right.
That's the additional four that are shown on lines 24 to 26. And the dash, the difference between dash 1 and dash 2, as I was just pointing out with Vice Chair Berger, is that the language on lines 20 and 21 is either that which is bracketed I met with some of the BPOE folks, and they were concerned about the removal of the language, and I said that language doesn't even necessarily apply to the BPOE the way that it's written right now.
Oh, but it does.
And so by leaving the bracket of information, leaving the brackets on that information, the Grand and Subordinate Lodges of the Masons and the Grand and Subordinate Lodges of the Knights of Pythias would then be, that language would just leave it as limited to the Masons, the Knights of Pythias, so on and so forth. They thought that language should be left in there, feeling that it applied to them as the benevolent and protective order of the Elks, and I said it isn't even in there to benefit the order of the Elks, it looks like to me. It's just the other two orders. So, colleagues, that's the primary difference between the two. It removes what appears to be some very superfluous information from the statute. And I know that the Elks thought it ought to stay in there, but we didn't hear from the Masons, nor did we hear from the or any of the Grand and Subordinate Lodges of the Masons, nor any of the Grand and Subordinate Lodges of the Knights of Pythias, unless they're here today at the dais. So, with that, Representative...
Yes, I don't believe we heard from any Odd Fellows.
Didn't you listen to me as I was talking?
I'm glad he said that.
You weren't here the last time this came up and had all kinds of problems, and I was appointed to a work group.
Oh,
dealing with this, and we met for days on this.
So you met with the Knights of Pythias.
So there were a lot of Odd Fellows involved.
We have a volunteer for character. Is that it?
I Mary has done yeoman's work in tracking a lot of these people down, and I did meet with Representative Gilman just before our session here, and he's fine with this. And I also met with Groverson, or talked to Grover about his concerns, which were the deletions. So. They're both happy, assuming
the dash
exchange.
Which dash?
Because you got dash one or dash two. So dash two. Okay. All right. Representative Hass now moves the dash twos. Is there any further discussion? We got to discuss.
Just for the record,
standing up here.
I'm not going to oppose this, but just for the record, the Grand and Subordinate Lodges and Elks does have those same ones, so it does apply to the Elks. But
in
lieu of the hard work Representative Hass has, I will defer to his expertise.
And I would say that it does not show it in statute. That's the problem with what we're talking about here. So. But with the dash two amendments, it removes it entirely and just leaves the organization name, and they can sort it out amongst their lodges, whether they be exalted or subordinate. So, with that, colleagues, is there any objection to the dash two amendments being appended? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Comp is excused. Representative Hass now moves the 2511 to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Any objection? Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Hass, inasmuch as you've been the exalted word group leader.
I am an Odd Fellow. There's no doubt about that. But I'd be happy to, unless Representative Gilman.
Let's put this back to Representative Gilman. He's invested in it severely.
Okay.
So I think that's an excellent thing to do. Representative George Gilman is the gentleman who will carry this. With that, we will close the work session on 2511, open work session 2234.
Okay.
House Bill 2234, as amended, dash A4 is what I received for the amendment, removes the existing restriction on the number of electronic enterprise zones that can be located within existing enterprise zones, extends the deadline from December 31st, 2006 to 2009 for applicants to obtain required certification for property tax exemptions and corporate tax for credits for facilities located in non-urban zones. The amendment, which I should add up at the top there, I'm sorry, I didn't, creates a beginning date of July 1, 2007, which after which the proposed limitation is removed until the proposed sunset date on the number of electronic zones that may be created. So the difference between your original version that we reviewed is this additional constraint, so to speak. It limits it imposes a longer sunset date, but it also creates an initial date. It moves that out to July 1, 2007, as opposed to what it previously was, which was the effective date of the bill. Right.
Colleagues, it's my understanding that this was extended, the beginning time was extended until July 1st of 2007 to perhaps give the other two e-commerce enterprise zones an extra opportunity to try and catch up with the large number in Roseburg. Or was it Medford?
Actually, we're up to 32, I just found out.
Oh, man.
So there's 34 in the state, and 32 of them are in Medford.
Can we use this bill to shut Medford down?
I heard that here.
I'm sorry. Actually, what this does is gives Burns and Northeast Portland an opportunity to
come to the plan.
And Medford cannot have any more until Burns catches up with Northeast with Medford, I think. And then it opens this up for the sunset period.
It also reduces the impact, Mr. Chair.
The financial impact is reduced too?
Yes, because you're moving out the beginning date. So your FY05-07 is zero, and your first impact is going to be in 07-09.
And that's been run through the OTEMs, so that takes into consideration any jobs that are created.
I did not run it through.
Oh, okay.
OTEM.
So this is just the fiscal impact of the property tax. Okay. Okay.
No, there's a corporate in there, too. I'm sorry. We didn't run the corporate impact. The corporate impact is probably between 6 and 9 million loss, in depending on how it's phased. I did one simulation where we assumed that the full credit could be taken. The liability would be such that the full credit could be taken in the first year, and the second simulation assumed that you'd take a partial and then spread it out, spread your liabilities, carrying them forward up to 5 years.
That's a lost corporate tax that we're not presently collecting. Okay. All right. Colleagues, Representative Galizio.
Just a question. Were there any other bills with e-commerce zones? This is the sole bill?
No, there's at least one more in the House. Representative Riley, aren't you hearing one?
Well, what
that we've heard on this committee.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's my question. Yeah.
This is the only one we're hearing on e-commerce zone, the e-commerce zones. What we're hearing is a bill to expand the enterprise zones.
Right.
And that'll be coming here. What this does lets you have it on any enterprise zone. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what the other bill does is expand the number of enterprise zones. So that bill will also create an impact on this bill.
Correct.
Okay. Doris, did you need to add anything?
No.
Please, come
yes.
forward.
Good.
I think Doris has testified in your committee, too.
Yes. Representative Butler, members of the committee. Representative Riley, yes, there are other bills. I'm sorry, Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties.
Thank you, Doris.
There is another e-commerce zone bill, and I'm sorry I don't have the number for it right now, that was sponsored by the Telecommunications Coordinating Council that actually wanted to extend e-commerce zones to 10. And I don't think that's gone anywhere because this bill was more in action.
Okay. Okay.
And so,
But there is a, I think that there's an amendment to one of those bills that extends the e-commerce. One of them was to extend the e-commerce to each of the enterprise zones.
Well, that's what this one does now.
Right.
This one started
but
out.
But not until later.
This one started out as 10
right.
and has been amended to all, is the way I see it.
Okay.
That's correct. Chair Butler, yes, in the other committee it was expanded to all, and then when it came here you discussed extending, putting it off until 2007
and
to implement.
It just delays that happening. But any enterprise zone could then be an e-commerce zone.
If this bill is passed.
If they chose to request that they be an e-commerce zone. It's a local option.
They could be. It doesn't make them automatic.
Right. Okay. Right.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Galeen.
I remember having concerns about what constitutes an e-zone in terms of what could be done where, you know, you sort of, the threshold didn't seem very high, and where, I just remember having concerns that you could create an e-zone and that the criteria weren't very strong. In other words, I was concerned about even actually outsourcing and just putting some telephones and some, you know, so.
Chair Butler, Representative Galizio. I think it might be helpful if you heard from Art Fish with the department just briefly, because he can explain the parameters around establishing an e-commerce qualification within an enterprise zone, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, let's have Art Fish come forward from the OECD.
I'm sorry.
Let's do that.
Well, you've opened up a can of worms now.
Yeah.
I remember what happened in your committee the other day, and I didn't want to. Can you just address this issue and let's get on with it, Art?
Yes, yes, Chair Butler, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and I know I've seen you've had a grueling day, and I don't wish to trouble you further. But to Representative Galizio's question, members of the committee, Chair Butler. I guess, you know, there are several parameters that you might have in mind. First of all, the creation of an enterprise zone does depend on some local economic hardship numbers. For example, one way is if your unemployment rate locally is at least 2 percentage points above the state level. And so we're applying that now with respect to current local applicants by cities, counties for a zone. If you're a business in an enterprise zone, then you have to increase your jobs. That's the main requirement to get it, just that 3-year exemption on your new property from property taxes. And that can be extended to a couple more years if you pay what really does amount to very remarkable compensation to the people involved. And a great many projects use that extended abatement now. With respect to the e-commerce zones, you know, with the 4 that were allowed, the bill was originally introduced on the request of the department, would have only increased that to 10. And then, as Representative Riley alluded to, their committee increased that to essentially the universe of existing enterprise zones, however many that may be. But to get an e-commerce designation, despite having to maybe compete against other zones, if there's a limited number, there really isn't any special requirements. And a business that would use the e-commerce tax credit only has to meet the same requirements that underpin any other enterprise-owned business. But they do, of course, have to apply, and they, of course, have to be involved in e-commerce. And so the point of that is really to open it up a little bit more with the property tax side, but to provide this extra incentive on the income tax side so that e-commerce businesses are especially induced to expand, and it's going to have a sort of hit and miss effect for a while. And Medford has definitely been a hit, as I think the good chair alluded to. But there are some other areas that are still waiting a little bit. With that,
Lizio, is that responsive?
Yeah, I mean, like, this was my concern with when we heard this before. It's like, in this day and age, what constitutes an e-commerce business? I mean, you could say anything does. Yeah. You can have bricks and mortar. I mean, the way it was defined first time was like, you have bricks and mortar, but you have a computer and you do things online. It's an it's e-commerce business. Right? What is an
okay.
There must be strict parameters.
There are. Representative Butler, Representative Galizio, members of the committee, yes, there are. And in fact, you're correct. Any business could have an e-commerce aspect. Okay, now they do have to be, and so e-commerce is eligible. A great many e-commerce businesses or businesses with e-commerce aspects could use an enterprise zone for the property tax benefit anyway. And that's something I've talked with staff a great deal about, which is that, you know, the property tax side was not greatly changed when it comes to an e-commerce designation, because call centers and other types of entities are already allowed for regular enterprise zones. Now, what they get the tax credit on is specifically defined to assets that are invested or capital assets that go towards e-commerce. So, yeah, I mean, if you're really doing a lot of e-commerce and you're building a building to do e-commerce, yeah, you could include the bricks and mortar. But if it's really just an aspect of your business, it might only be, for example, the computer equipment. And so your tax credit that you can claim on 25% of that asset cost is going to vary depending upon the extent of e-commerce. Does that help you at all?
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Representative Galizia, or Representative Riley, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm a manufacturer in one of these enterprise zones and my primary product is baby shoes, okay, and I have some folks who look up stuff on the internet or contact customers on the internet, what portion of my business would be eligible for this credit?
Chair Butler, Representative Riley, members of the committee, it would depend upon how much you've invested in e-commerce activities. If you've opened up a whole new call center or facility to handle those transactions, then it could be that facility. But if you're only adding a certain amount to your marketing side or whatever that handles those types of orders or works with your suppliers on a B2B basis using the internet as a platform, and it's somewhat specified, and we've developed rules that break this down very specifically in terms of how far you can go with that, but it could be very limited. And so I think your example, I was getting the sense that this is a fairly small business making shoes, and they're adding just an internet component to their overall marketing scheme. And they're not like Amazon.com, per se.
Three computers and a couple of guys.
It might be the three computers and so forth. If they would each have to be worth any personal property like that, now you're going to get me going, but any of the personal property like that, that item, a personal property, would have to cost at least $1,000 in order to be qualified property, and that would allow them to use the enterprise zone and then claim the credit based on the cost of the assets, assuming they had tax liabilities to use it against. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Thank you.
And the call center jobs could be in India.
No.
Okay. Chair Butler, Representative Galizia, members of the committee. What would have to be in the enterprise zone, however, is the capital assets for the e-commerce, the qualified property that allows them to use the enterprise zone, and the increase in employment of people full-time working in the enterprise zone, too. So even though there certainly could be an overseas connection, it would not be sufficient without that enterprise zone serious nexus.
And the number of jobs created in the enterprise zone.
Yes, creation of jobs.
Representative Hass?
Yes, sir. Mr. Fish, I'm just sorry that Mr. Fox isn't here. I want to go back to my 6 months and talk to Mr. Fish and Mr. Fox.
We could do that for you someday.
Did you make the amendment?
This,
where did the amendment?
Representative Haas, Chair Butler, members of the committee, we're not, I have no idea about the order.
Mary, do you know anything about the A4 amendment?
Yeah. That's the amendment that changes the delays the starting date.
Right.
That's the A4.
Okay.
We originally got 2234A.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know what was in between.
Okay. So somebody had three amendments in the prior committee, and four is what delays the start of it here. Okay. Further, Representative Hass.
Are you ready for a...
I am indeed. Representative Hass.
I would move House Bill 2234 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
We've got A4s that need to be amended, passed.
In keeping with today's theme of not delaying these spending bills, I would rather use the date that's in there.
So
when I look at the language, I don't think that messes with the bill much, other than that change date.
The doesn't it have a revenue effect?
Yes, it delays the revenue by moving the starting date out. It reduces the FY07, 0507 biennium.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. To your further to the representative's motion. Representative Boquist.
Therefore, what is the revenue impact of the maintenance?
Originally, right now under the dash four.
No, so under the amendment, he didn't move the dash four.
No, he didn't move the amendment.
He did not move the amendment.
So what is the revenue impact
without that?
For his motion.
As needed.
Right.
Go back to the original.
Got it in hand. It was roughly 0.1 million for 06-07 and 0.22 million for 07-08. I had originally given you a handout like this, so combined it was roughly 0.2 million for the 06. I'm sorry, 05-07 would be 0.1, mm-hmm. and 07-09 would be roughly 0.5 million.
For the question,
yes,
so $200,000 for the buy-in, right?
That's for the property tax issue. And then on the corporate, the 05-07 was 5 million loss, and 07-09 was roughly 15 million, I believe. So we're moving all that out by taking the amended version 4.
We're not doing version 4. I'm confused now.
Yeah, well, that's
taken out.
What is the motion?
The motion is to move without the dash 4 amendment.
And without the dash 4 amendment, the total revenue impact of this motion for 0507, yes.
0507 for corporate would be 5.323 million for 0507, and it would be for property tax, it would be 0.1 million negative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Does this need a subsequent?
Does not require. We're gonna stand at ease for just a moment here. Back in the session, work session here, the reason for the dash A4 amendment is to delay the implementation, not necessarily for revenue purposes, but to delay it for those other Northeast Portland and the other zones to try and have an opportunity, Roseburg and Northeast Portland Burns, to get back up and running under this experimental program. So the motion before us, and we're under discussion right now. The motion before us is to pass the 2234 without the A4 amendment, and I'm very concerned about that. I would like to have an opportunity to move the A4, I think what we'll do is we'll vote on the 2234 without the A4 amendment, and then still have an opportunity, if that fails, to come back and append the A4 and then reconsider. Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, to make all the parliamentarians happy here, just to clarify here, Mayor, what you're saying is the revenue impact is between $5 and $10 million in the next biennium on the present motion.
On corporate, yes, Representative Boquist. And about $0.1 million on the property tax.
So total revenue impact of this motion combined
could be about $10.1 million.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Clerk will call the roll. The question is to pass the 2234 to the House, do pass without amendment from this committee as A engrossed in previous committee.
Okay. Representative Boquist.
No.
Representative Esperdell.
No.
Representative Felicio.
No.
Representative Tomp.
No.
Representative Riley.
No.
Vice Chair Berger.
No.
Vice Chair Hass.
No.
And Chair Butler.
Butler votes no. With that, the motion to pass 2234 without the A4 fails. Chair now moves the A4 amendment be appended to the 2234A. My motion is made, colleagues, under discussion to let you know that I do believe that it's very important that the three other enterprise zones have an opportunity, e-commerce zones have an opportunity to enjoy some of the same experience that you've had in your area, and that we not move so fast in expanding the commerce e-commerce zones. Is there any objection? Any further discussion to append the A4? Any objections in adding the A4? Hearing and seeing none, we will append the A4. Representative.
Can we do this?
Yes, we can do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I would move House Bill 2234 as an A engrossed with the dash four amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
To your motion, you've heard the motion. Is there discussion? Representative Hass.
Thanks. I appreciate your explanation of it. This gives some areas time to get ready, but this just doesn't feel like it's ready to go yet. There's some questions. I share some of the same concerns that Representative Galizio has, but mostly it's this notion of putting expenditures off. And it hurts that I don't want to oppose this. I was one of the co-sponsors of the original e-commerce law in 2001. But I just am reluctant to keep delaying these expenditures and putting the responsibility to pay for this on future legislators.
Thank you very much, Representative Hass. And I would respond to that by saying also that one of the revenue losses is the fact that we are not collecting, and that's what it is, we're not collecting taxes on businesses that aren't here. And so that is a rather ambiguous kind of an expenditure, and I look at that and I say that, and certainly a portion of the revenue loss is the loss in the property tax that are available in these e-commerce zones. But I'm always anxious about treating as a true loss to the general fund taxes that we're not presently collecting, but that we would anticipate in new businesses moving to town and then foregoing those. With that, the motion to move 2234 with the A4 appended as amended a second time then would be to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Is there dissenting votes to that motion?
Yeah, I'm going to vote now.
Okay. Let's call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esperdell?
Yes.
Representative Felicio?
No.
Representative Tom?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hass?
Aye.
And Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. With that, we will move 2234 as with the A4 amended to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Do you want me to carry the bill?
Yeah. Would you want to Pigs will fly. Butler will carry that bill to the House. I close the work session on 2234 and close revenue for today. We'll see you at even time.